are paying through MCOs, they have access PCMZ and even on those fee-for-services accounts. Why are our numbers still at 63.3? I went home last night and said, you guys got to be crazy to let that pass your committee. This is terrible. What can we do? What do you suggest?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we did go back and talk about that after the meeting yesterday and spent some time on that. Some of our staff is doing some research as we speak and is going to do a write-up on the things that impact this and the possible ways of making some improvements in this area. It certainly will have to be a cooperative effort between ourselves and the Public Health Division, which has more resources to deal with the immunization issue, and we do intend to do that.
What about, do we have any goals or performance measure around that piece?
Madam Chair, this one measure is our measure that we use, but Public Health does have also a measure around immunizations, and we will be working with the immunization coordinators in the immunization program in Public Health on this issue.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, can I add this to those comments? We do work with the managed care organizations and monitor immunization rates of the individual health care plans, even for the individual immunizations. And so this performance measure that's presented in the report is actually a compilation of a lot of different immunizations, and the actual rates for the individual immunizations are better. But we do monitor the plans and give them comparisons with each other. So there are there is priority that the department can, or the division can put to make sure the plans are emphasizing that as a priority. I think there are interventions that we can make on the parent and client level to make sure the parents understand the importance. And in fact, the report does describe the Healthy Start, Grow Smart educational information that's provided in various languages to the OHP clients. So there are some things we can do on the client level, some things we can do on the managed care plan level, and then basically things that we need to do on a health system-wide level to make sure that immunizations and that type of preventive service are appropriately compensated and emphasized. So,
Representative Cortez. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really glad that you spent some time talking about this yesterday after. This is an important issue, and I just take a little issue with, you do need to work with Public Health on immunization, but these are clients that we are paying capitated rates to cover them, and their immunization rates are not up to snuff, and we need to fix that. So I'm glad that you're going to talk about how we can work with the contractors on that. There are uninsured folks who have immunization issues. That is primarily the domain of Public Health, in my mind. We've got folks who are insured on the health plan. The kids should be immunized. They should be up to at least where we are average for the state. So I'm glad that you're working on it. I look forward to the report on it, on what you think we can do with the contractors.
Senator Wardley. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I do appreciate you giving us a chance to reflect on what we heard yesterday. But I would also remind us that what we heard from Public Health in previous testimony is that they have been underfunded for a period of time. And again, we're talking about our public health partners mm-hmm. around the state, underfunded. And then when you look at the co-chair's budget and the zeroing out of modest amount of funding for public health, again, that's our partner, and that's where we have the expectation that our public partner will help do some of the work around immunizations and in other areas. So unless we being the legislature, are willing to walk our talk and put the revenue enhancements in place that will allow public health to do its job on behalf of Oregon citizens, including providing immunizations for every child who deserves to have it, to have this, then we just need to be real clear about what we're talking about. That we have an expectation, but we're not putting forth the revenue that makes the expectation real out there around the state. And I have the co-chair's budget compared to the governor's budget right in front of me. And again, looking up if that zero in public health as compared to about a little over $4 million that the governor would have put into public health says volumes to me about what our choices are in this session and where we're going to place investments. And it's just deeply troubling and not acceptable.
So I think the question now becomes that since we've zeroed out at this point public health, and there is no state level need for them to come to the table on this issue, then I need you guys to be very creative in terms of working with your other partners and different kind of backhold in terms of where we go from here, because public health has said their directives basically are federally funded, and so we will have to hope that they will want to work collaboratively with you, Dr. Schaefer, in terms of how we get more kids immunized. I'm worried about any threat of disease that could come as a result of so many kids lacking immunizations. Mr. Edge.
Madam Chair, yes, we totally agree. We will do what we can working with our managed care partners to deal with the Medicaid children and get those immunization rates up, but it's important that the statewide rate be raised also, which is an issue for the entire state. The public health system, the school health system might be able to assist with this issue. It's important that we keep what's called herd immunity, enough people immunized so that an epidemic doesn't get started in any particular disease.
Exactly. One of the things I'd like to see us do, and I'd like to work with you on it, and that is if we are lucky enough to get the Healthy Kids program passed, how we can set up systems to take a good look at this. And so I'd like you to get in touch with me and let's have a conversation around that piece.
Madam Chair, yes, the Healthy Kids program should help us, give us a real tool to deal with this and help us to get that right up.
Exactly. Thank you very much. Further questions or comments? Thank you very much, Dr.
All right, Madam Chair, I will say that having a higher percentage of children covered, insured by Medicaid and the CHIP program will clearly help decrease one of the barriers to providing immunizations. Another thing that will help is the managed care system should help, and promotion of medical homes that comes from the managed care system and from some of the other demonstration projects that you're considering, because medical homes do promote a higher rate of immunizations, and there is some evidence of that. So when families have a home where they expect to receive all services, they tend to receive their immunizations because the medical home is keeping track of the needs of that population that they're responsible for.
So. Madam Chair, just one more comment on this before we read off it, and I wanted to raise the issue that we know that when parents are getting regular health care, they're more likely to get regular health care for their children, and I think the closure of OHP standards has had an impact on kids getting immunizations. When the parents are not able to get those immunizations, or the parents are not able to get regular health care, that program has shrunk and has been closed for a long time. And that would make an impact also on children's immunization rates.
Thank you for that insight, because I bet you're right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question I meant to ask earlier about a month ago, and didn't get a chance to. Now, what are the real barriers for getting kids immunized? And there are some cultural barriers. But what I see the biggest barriers is, one, access. Most of the health departments that I know of, and I may be wrong about this, aren't open after 5 o'clock at night or on weekends. We have two people working in most of these families now. Secondly, is cost sometimes, especially if you go to your private physician. These cost, these are really expensive shots by the time you get those done. They're complicated and difficult to do. And, you know, the last time I remember an immunization program really taking off and doing well was a long time ago when I got my shot vaccine at school. And we don't have much as far as school-based is being done either now. And the real barriers are right down there, nitty-gritty, where parents are trying to get their kids immunized, want to get them immunized, and they have barriers. They can't take time off to work to get their kids in for an immunization. They can't get it at school. How do you address those real problems, the real barriers to people getting those shots?
Madam Chair, Dr. Bates, Senator Bates, those are all serious barriers, serious considerations statewide, not just for the Medicaid population. I hope we can partner on that and deal with those things. One of the issues you raised is a possible partnering we might be able to do with the Department of Education and working with the school systems. But we will do what we can, primarily with our managed care plans, since that's where 75% of our services are provided, but also working with public health departments and private physicians and school systems, and it's something that is a statewide issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further question?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, in addition, we do partner with the federal government on for the cost issue for the vaccines. The Vaccines for Children program has been in existence since 1994, and that really has helped with one of the barriers, because the immunization themselves are provided free or at low cost. There are still administration fees that providers charge, but for low-income and Medicaid clients, at least the cost of the vaccines is shared and provided by the federal government, so that does help.
Well, I don't want to proffer an answer necessarily to a center-based question, but I certainly will.
That's usual.
Thank you. Look, the issue here isn't about this little snippet program or this little bite at the outside of the apple or this little tweak to an existing program. The answer is found in changing fundamentally how we deliver health care in this state. And I've had these conversations with Jim, and I know he fundamentally agrees. Look, kind of the two leading edge organizations in this state at trying to do things, do more with less, and do things better in an innovative fashion are the FCHIPS and PEB. They're really doing innovative, you know, look over the horizon type work. So, I mean, we've got to be very thankful and appreciative and learn some lessons, Senator Bates. I know that's the answer you wanted to hear. Now, from PEB and the FCHIPS. That's what the real answer here is, and getting more primary care physicians into this state. That's a key component in just, you know, the access for these, I agree with you, Jim, for these parents that don't have access to health care, getting their kids down there to get immunized or dental work, you know that. So the answer is getting more physicians into this state and allowing them to deliver health care in a different manner. It's a big task. And we're going to need all the help we can possibly get from you and the FCHIPS and PEB, and we're all in this boat. We've all got to start rowing in the same direction.
Mr. Westland, we totally agree.
No, we'll hear a comment.
Well, pick up your oar.
But yeah, that's what happens when you're talking when you should be listening. You get together. Any other questions for this panel?
Is Scano through?
No, I think we're done with the immunization issue discussion.
No, no, you're through.
You had your flu vaccine and your Rona vaccine.
What was the question about?
Have you had your pneumonia vaccine?
I had mine every year until this year. All right. I'm going to try to get through two brief descriptive measures starting on page 48. And these are mostly for information, and they are kind of interesting. The first one deals with the proportion of births covered by Oregon Health Plan. And you'll notice on the table on page 48, the percentage of births covered on OHP has slowly risen over the last few years up to almost 45% of births in Oregon. The percentage of uninsured births has slowly fallen to around 3%. So it is, in many ways, good news that we're able to cover that many pregnancies, and it certainly reflects the work of the Oregon Mother's Care Project to try to get women who are pregnant enrolled in OHP. It is noteworthy that 45% of the babies born in Oregon are born into families that meet the low-income qualifications for OHP, which for pregnancy is 185% of the federal poverty level. And the comparisons with other states are on the table on page 49, and you'll see, although there's a lot of variation, and there's variation in the way the statistics are collected, that Oregon seems to be in the kind of in the range that most of the western states cover. Washington's at 45.9%, and we're in this 45% range in spite of some variation in the percentage of FPL that's covered on for pregnant women on the Medicaid programs. And then the last measure that I have in this section is the percentage of children covered by OHP. That's on page 50, and again, you'll see the percentage of children has been slowly rising over the last few years, up to a little over 25%. It's been rising in total numbers and rising in percentage of the population. Again, the comparison table on page 51 shows that Oregon is basically in the middle of the rankings of states at by covering 25%. We're at position number 26 in the states. And we still have 12% of Oregon's children uninsured, and so presumably if the Healthy Kids Plan were enacted, that would raise our percentage and raise our ranking in the states. That's pretty much what I had to report on these measures. Questions?
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, we're considerably behind schedule, so we'll try to move along quickly here. The next section is quality and efficiency improvements, and Ms. Lebanski will cover that section.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alice Lebanski, and I am the Operations Section Manager for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, and I will be walking you through pages 53 through 57, covering the efforts we are putting into quality and efficiency improvements. Starting on page 53, the first subheading titled Managed Care Enhancements. The Division of Medical Assistance Programs has a goal of achieving 80% enrollment in physical medical managed care. We are currently at 76.2% of meeting that goal. The chart on page 53 shows Oregon Health Plan clients enrolled in a physical medical managed care plan over years 2002 through 2006. The chart shows a 13% gain in enrollment since 2002. We did have a slight decrease in enrollment in 2003 due to reductions in the standard benefit plan. Most of our plans dropped the standard package, but when the standard benefit package changed in August 2004, plans did begin accepting the standard population again. We use several methods in our auto-enrollment process to foster managed care enrollment. You'll see these as bullets on pages 53 and continues on page 54. Our computer system performs a monthly auto-enrollment process, enrolling clients into managed care unless they have already selected a plan or they are exempt from managed care enrollment. We also enroll clients weekly through a manual process. We recently made a change moving to a weekly auto-enrollment process for mental health. This change has resulted in clients being enrolled much more quickly in managed care, and it's also increased the mental health managed care enrollment. Moving to the top of page 54, we continue to reinforce the benefits of managed care enrollment through outreach efforts on a regular basis with our DHS field offices. And we also have regional meetings across the state with DH workers, managed care plans, and other interested stakeholders to share information on the Oregon Health Plan. Recently, DMAP expanded managed care access in Jackson County by contracting with Mid-Rogue Independent Physicians Association. Jackson County will continue to remain voluntary at this time because of limited provider capacity. But it is our hope that this new expansion will over time result in mandatory enrollment in Jackson County.
Madam Chair?
Senator Bates.
I'd like to just make a comment. Thank you for bringing us up to speed in this. This is something I spent the last 6 months getting done in Jackson County, about to drove myself crazy, which wasn't a big push in some cases. We expect and hope to be, we're signing contracts April 1st, I believe, so we'll probably sign contracts a day or two ago, and we hope this to be, our account to be mandatory by the end of the year.
Yeah,
or maybe even earlier. It primarily depends on me getting out of session, getting back down there and talking to about 150 physicians by going around my community and making them understand the program. If we get out here June 29th, I think we'll be ready to roll to mandatory county on the 1st of January. So we're looking forward to doing that for you. But you got to get me out of here, okay? That's the key thing there, okay? Thank you, Madam Chair.
You bet.
And that's
providing meals as well. Moving to helping OHP standard clients maintain eligibility.
Thursday morning.
Effective June 1, 2006, DHS stopped requiring premiums for OHP clients who were at 10% or below the federal poverty level. In addition, clients above 10% of the federal poverty level are no longer disqualified from OHP for failure to pay their premiums. This allows.
Can we go back to that?
Yes.
Because are we still enrolling every 6 months? That people have to come back every 6 months and re-enroll?
We do still have, for some of our clients, a 6-month recertification process. Clients can still lose qualification from OHP for failure to pay premiums at the end of their 6 months. We will require them to pay any premium arrearages at that time.
So it's not just a matter of re-enrolling, it's a matter of paying your premium, and that automatically re-enroll you for another 6 months? Is that
and right? They would have a recertification process at the end of 6 months as well, in addition to paying any premium arrearages.
So what does that prove? What does that do, let me say? Because I've heard a lot of people really have lost their insurance because of the every 6 month requirement, and it looked like people would tend to be more organized on a yearly basis as opposed to every 6 months. Why do you do every 6 months as opposed to every year?
Madam Chair, what I can share with you is that we have recently removed one of the barriers for our Children's Health Insurance Program, our CHIP children,
right.
And we've lengthened their certification period from 6 months to 12 months, and that was effective June 1st, 2006.
Great.
And that was based on a study from the Oregon Health Research and Evaluation Collaborative, mm-hmm. And they found that one of the reasons children were going without health insurance coverage was because of some of the administrative burden and the hurdles that they had to jump through.
Right.
And so we feel that by making that window longer for them, that that will help with those hurdles and those barriers.
Right.
As far as answering your questions, as far as other categories of eligibles who maybe have a 12-month certification period, I'd have to go back and get some information for you because I am not an expert on eligibility, but we will certainly bring that information back to you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morse.
Thank you. We passed a bill last session that would not cut people off at the beginning of that period if they didn't pay their premium. We allowed them to do a catch-up once they're into that six-month period. So that was a huge, made a huge difference, because otherwise if they missed their first premium, they were cut off and they couldn't enroll again until the end of the 6 months. So we've extended that time period. Now, that's a statutory fix, and if we wanted to do it for 12 months, we need another statutory fix. So we did improve the system somewhat.
Okay. Senator Bates?
Yes, Madam Chair. My memory of this, and I think LFO can help me here with this, is that we used to have one-year enrollment. It worked well, functioned well. It matched up what was commercially done in most cases. And that change was made, and it was hotly debated when it occurred, and it was a compromise between two warring parties over this at a time of budgetary restraints. And I think it's long past the time that should be changed back. I don't know if you need statutory change to get that done, or it's administrative rule. But I think LFO may be able to give that answer. If not, we'll find out. But it is an unnecessary, from my point of view, burden on administration to keep changing every 6 months. It's difficult for patients to follow. And it's just inappropriate, as far as I'm concerned, an inappropriate way of dealing with this healthcare system. I would like to see one-year enrollment as a logical extension. We should go forward with as quickly as possible. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and Senator Bates, we would be happy to implement a one-year enrollment period. There is a cost to it. It would take the statutory change that Senator Morissette referred to. But we did move during this last year to one-year enrollment for children, for the Children's Health Insurance Program. And first, I think we have to reopen the OHP standard program, but then in that program, which has the six-month eligibility period, with adequate funding, we could move to a one-year, with adequate funding and your direction, we could move to a one-year enrollment period.
Representative Cortez?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions on the CHIP enrollment.
Last year that I did.
Is it 12 months for Oregon House Plan for children, or just 12 months? I should know this, but when you just said that, and it made me question. In Healthy Kids, we talk about 12-month enrollment. Is that only for the Oregon House Plan, and what we have in the central budget is for the CHIP? Kids?
Madam Chair, it's children. It's the Children's Health Insurance Program and the Medicaid children.
So it's both. Okay. Thank you. The way you were saying that, I wasn't wanted to double check.
Follow up? And then Representative Garrard after you.
Thank you. The money we need to have the kids at 12 months, that is in the central budget level, or is that... Is it in the governor's budget? I'm just trying to figure out if that's connected to Healthy Kids or not.
Madam Chair and Representative Kotek, that was a change that was made during the biennium last year when a change was made at the direction of the legislature to take some maintenance of effort money from the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program and move it to Department of Human Services and make that change in the children's eligibility period. And we made that change. We had to get a waiver approval from CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and made that change with would have been with general funds and matching federal funds.
Follow-up.
Did that answer your question?
And on page 3 of the addendum 1, it talks about CHIP renewal period from 6 to 12 months as part of the phase-in package 021. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to decide, this is part of the essential budget level. or is it something we need to make sure gets in the co-chair's budget, or is it connected to healthy kids?
Would you ask your question again for me?
Sure. Page 3 of...
On the page.
Right. So in the phase-in package, package 021, there's a phase-in of the CHIP renewal period change from 6 to 12 months. We did it for the second half of this biennium. We want to continue it through the next biennium. I guess I'm trying to make sure that the I see 8.5 and other funds. So that is tobacco tax? Is that... This is a very important piece that we need to make sure happens.
The other funds there would be tobacco tax.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Bittner, and then we'll come back to you.
Pardon me. I want to make sure we're all clear on this.
Okay.
I think what Representative Kotek was asking was, does the essential budget level include the roll-up or the phase-in from CHIP? And I think the answer to that is yes. And I think it's exactly where you pointed out. But the other question was, is the non-CHIP children's component of OHP, is eligibility moved from 6 to 12 months on that? And I'm not sure of the answer. Do you know, Eric? Or when? Okay.
Madam Chair, let me call on my short period of time in this new position and the fact that I told you I might stumble once or twice and rely on Lynn for an answer. Lynn says that the CHIP is part of the essential budget package. The Plum Children program, the Medicaid Children program, is in the Healthy Kids program.
So that is not an essential budget component. That is a policy option package. These are the Healthy Kids. So the Plum, the poverty level medical children's piece, going from 6 to 12 months is part of Healthy Kids.
Thank you.
Right. You just answered my question.
Okay. Proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to be moving to page 55, leading OHP clients to appropriate care. Since 2002, DMAP has provided a disease management program to eligible fee-for-service clients. The disease management program helps clients receive the care and education they need to better manage their health by offering members immediate access to clinically sound services such as client assessment, care planning, and delivery of services. DMAP partners with McKesson Health Solutions to manage the disease management program, and approximately 8,700 clients are currently enrolled. The outcomes we are looking to achieve with the disease management program are reductions in medical costs, improved clinical outcomes, and delivery system changes. Originally, the program only included asthma, diabetes, and heart failure. In December 2005, DMAP added chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and coronary artery disease to the program. The program works in adherence to providers' treatment plans and evidence-based guidelines through individual counseling by a registered nurse who conducts either a face-to-face disease case monitoring or through telephonic contact. All OHP fee-for-service clients who meet specific diagnosis or treatment codes are enrolled in the disease management program at no cost to the client. However, if the client does not wish to participate in the program, they may opt to be disenrolled. Another improvement...
Can I just stop you for a minute? So, Mr. Edge, I've been on back at this immunization thing here. So we have these people... And they are in paid programs. Why is there not some kind of mandate that being in these programs, is, and especially even if they have gotten out of the program, especially when they first get in the program for immunization?
Madam Chair, the managed care plans are capitated at a rate that pays for encounters with physicians, encounters with other providers, and Certainly the expectation is there that those physicians would be getting providing adequate immunizations for these children. But the Medicaid clients, as happens with other children throughout the state, don't always get those immunizations. And we've had discussion about the fact that our medical care system as it currently exists rushes people through the system at times. It isn't the most efficient system. We are talking about reform in the healthcare system, and I think this is just evidence that we do need some reform in the healthcare system, that it isn't doing the best for our children especially that it could.
Because isn't, in listening to your report, and isn't this considered a part of basic health care? And if it's considered a part of basic health care, it appears to me that that's where the zap should be. That whether you rush into the system or not, maybe some kind of chronological order of what basic health care is and making sure that it includes... includes immunization, because nurses can do that. You don't have to have the doctors to do that. Okay.
Madam Chair, we agree. And it's a combination of parents needing to take some responsibility in this area, the medical care system needing to take some responsibility, the school system needing to take some responsibility. We all need to be working together on this.
Okay. Representative Matheson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question comes from being a freshman and being exposed to all the many different agencies that have their fingers in these areas, but no one has the full answer. No one's responsible for the full program of providing health. My question is along the lines of immunization, but it carries forward to nutrition and to wellness and appropriate level of treatment. If children aren't receiving immunizations through visits to a doctor or some other kind of clinic, what role does this program have in interfacing with school-based clinics, for example? And when we allocate money to school-based clinics, community clinics, programs like this and other sorts of programs, how can it be that we allocate money to all of these places and we still cannot ensure that someone receives treatment somewhere in one of those places?
Madam Chair?
Can
I take a crack at that for you?
Okay.
In this country, we spend 100% more than any other country in the world per person on health care costs. Any way you want to look at it, we rank 20th to 30th industrialized nations in outcomes. And the reason is exactly what you said.
Because I know Dr. Schaefer is jumping at the bits wanting to get in on this. You want to be a part of this?
Oh, of course.
Okay. And the reason is exactly what you're talking about. We have a fragmented delivery system that is all over the map, with bits and pieces all over the state. F-CHIPS, managed care here, Kaiser there, school-based clinics here, safety net clinics there, and none of it's working together. It's all over the map. What this country and the state is crying out for is a central authority to start getting people to work together and coordinate themselves. To a certain degree, we're talking to the wrong people here. The F-CHIPS have done more than anybody else to start coordinating care inside these capitated groups. I would guess if you looked at their outcomes based on their population, they're going to be better than what's going on in the rest of the state as far as commercially insured patients, uninsured patients, and yes, even Medicare patients. So your question is exactly on, exactly, absolutely on. And that's what we have to change. We have to change how we deliver health care. One of the F-CHIPS right now is exploring the possibility of going to an entirely different way of delivering care, a wraparound service where you'll be assigned to a doctor, a nurse, a social worker, a mental health care worker, and it's all wrapped around. So a patient comes into the office, they're not being branded as they go through and seeing 35 patients a day. You sit down with that patient and find what they really need. whether it's social help, mental health help, immunizations, you name it, they get it, it's taken care of. Alaska has that model already. It's been very successful. And one of our FCHIPs is getting ready to move forward on that right as we speak. The other FCHIPs have attached to them social workers. So when you see a patient that's having difficulty, you actually have a social worker you can immediately call for help with that patient. The fever service people do not. And that's one of the reasons we're trying to move forward with that program. And there's actually a model. And we have the only active program for managed care, which we have close to 75% of our patients in managed care anywhere in the country. We're in a position to launch a great program out, and we even do a better job. We're talking about taking on Medicare clients. Some are talking about going into commercial insurance. Things can rapidly change. Using them as sort of a launch pad for a lot of what's going on. But your question is absolutely correct. That is the problem. We're out there working hard, and we're not working together. It's like six guys in a boat, all rowing in different ways. That boat is just circling and circling and circling. We need somebody to get everybody to row together. So I appreciate your questions right on. I'm sure you might offer a little bit more than I did, but that's where we're going with health care reform. Thank you for the question.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I completely agree with you in what you said, other than in one point. You said you think you may be talking to the wrong people. I think that our agency is exactly one of the groups of people that this discussion can be focused on. And we have had internal discussions amongst the executive staff at the Division of Medical Assistance Programs along the lines of how can we change, how can we promote change in the delivery system to get better results on primary care, preventive care, and health outcomes. So I think the combination of the legislature and this and our Oregon Health Plan agency can really serve to promote changes that we want, because you have the funding that we can give to us, and if we want our delivery system to achieve certain health outcomes, we can ask for those, whether it be improved immunization rates or better control of diabetes or whatever. And now what we're doing is paying for office visits. And what we'd like to get to is a system where we pay for health outcomes, pay these healthcare teams to meet a standard of healthcare outcomes. So I think that the types of healthcare reform that you're looking at and the types of demonstration projects to promote primary care, medical homes are really important, and they're something that I can speak for our division that we want to be a part of promoting. So.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. Mr. Bensky?
Madam Chair, for the sake of time, I was going to go ahead and move to page, we'll stay on 55.
Yeah.
Any questions thus far from Mr. Bensky? On the Medicaid Management Information System. Okay. Replacing our Medicaid Management Information System, our MMIS is our Medicaid computer system. Excuse me.
Madam Chair?
Excuse me.
A quick question. If you could give us at a later time what the cost of the McKesson program is, mm-hmm. and how you're measuring your outcomes.
That's a good question.
Thanks. I got sidetracked, sorry. No. I mean, I don't expect those kind of questions. I'm not trying to put people in the spot here. I'm just trying to get information, please. Okay, so just when you get a chance, drop that off to us.
Madam Carter and
Madam Chair.
Senator Bates, we will get that information to you. We are replacing our current Medicaid Management Information System, and it is an important tool in managing our Medicaid business. Included, you'll see in the bullets about what our current system provides for us. It processes and pays our Medicaid claims. We use it to set reimbursement rates. We use it to meet federal reporting requirements, providing data to state policymakers, and measuring program performance and quality, and tracking medical eligibility for over 700,000 Oregonians. The current MMIS is around 25 years old and is a mainframe system originally designed to process approximately 260,000 claims per month. Today, the system is processing, on average, 2.5 million claims per month. As our Medicaid business has grown more complex, advances in technology, and the need for a flexible system, it has become critical for us to replace our outdated system. The replacement of our MMIS, approved by the Legislative Assembly, is scheduled for sometime in 2008 and is currently being federally funded at 90%. Once the system is implemented, maintenance and operation of the new system will be 75% federally funded. Our new system will be web-based and will provide many technological improvements to support our provider needs, among them a self-secure web portal. The self-service web portal will offer free web-based billing capability to our providers, allowing providers to submit and correct their claims online, receiving immediate real-time claim responses. Prior authorizations. Providers can submit an authorization request and view the status of their request online. And providers will have the capability of even applying to participate as a provider with Medicaid online. The portal will offer real-time eligibility verification to providers and staff and provide clients and client advocates with information on finding a provider and driving directions to a provider's office and health information.
Madam Chair?
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Clark.
You know, I have trouble keeping my own home computer up to snuff all the time. And we hear agency after agency comes in and tells us they're upgrading, et cetera. How long is this upgrade good for? Or is there a time period when you again will have to update as fast as this technology is moving? Can you give us an idea of...
Madam Carter and Representative Garrard, our system, as I mentioned, is around 25 years old, and it is a mainframe system, and it's a huge effort rolling out a new system. It's one of the largest IT efforts that DHS has. And we are going to a web-based system, and it is state-of-the-art functionality. We do realize, though, over time we will have to make enhancements to the system. Right now we're in the process of rolling out version 1 of this new system in 2008, and again we feel that it is state-of-the-art.
And how, when you talk about enhancements, but how far down the line before you begin to enhance the next day?
At this time, we are already planning on a version 2.
Okay.
And as far as what's in version 2, the scope and the time frame, I cannot give you that information, but I certainly could provide you some more detail on what is going to be in version 2. But we do expect to have enhancements being made on, and that's part of a system. It's part of keeping a system operating. Especially with new developments in IT and health records, electronic health records, and things like that are being looked at. We do expect to make more enhancements in the future.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question, Representative Garrard?
Yes and no.
Okay.
But I think you answered it to the best anybody could answer it.
You want a date. You want to say 6 months from now we're going to be...
Yeah. And she wasn't going to give me that.
I tell you, that's a good job you did. I'm sitting in Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've been waiting about 6-7 years for this to roll out. I know it's been a huge undertaking. And one thing I'd like to point out, this system we presently have has worked amazingly well for what it was asked to do. We're putting out 10 times more claims per month than you ever planned in doing, and somehow made that thing look long, keep working. From a provider's point of view, frankly, it worked better than most commercial systems do, but it's showing some wear and tear. I'm starting to see it in our office. I'm just a little anxious here, and I want you to allay my fears. In 2008, you're actually going to go online with the new system. That's going to be a big change for a lot of people. How seamless will that be to providers? Do you expect it to be a huge change? There's a lot of retraining for providers? Or is this something that's going to be fairly smooth from your point of view?
Madam Carter, excuse me, and Senator Bates, We are in the process of developing a very comprehensive provider implementation support plan, and we will be rolling out training across the state to all providers, and the training will be tailored to provider specialty, the type of training that they will need in their staff, and we'll be covering the areas where we hope providers will have the most efficiency in their offices as well, as far as really focusing and marketing the web portal and moving off paper and pushing electronic, helping all of you learn how to use the web portal for eligibility verification and other tools that we'll be offering. And so it is a very comprehensive provider training plan.
What month do you plan to roll out? Because I plan to be out of the state, okay? And I just want to make sure I'm out of the state the right month.
Madam Carter and Senator Bates, we expect to have a new date for our system, an actual final implementation date very soon, probably within the next 1 to 2 months, that we'll be publishing that date.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to get airline reservation.
Yeah, we're not going to tell you, so
we're not going to tell you.
Yeah.
We didn't get the answer either.
No.
Smart woman. Please go forward.
Thank you. Moving to page 56. Pharmacy program efficiencies. First, we'll start with the pharmacy lock-in program. DMAP currently has a mandatory pharmacy management program that requires most clients who are not enrolled in a physical medical managed care plan to get all of their medications from a single pharmacy. The problem with this model is it takes a great deal of staff resources managing the exceptions for patients not likely to benefit from this program. The goals of this program are to reduce prescription drug abuse caused by doctor shopping and drug-seeking behavior through inappropriate clinic and ER use. Currently, 75,000 clients are enrolled in the pharmacy management program. The governor's recommended budget eliminates the mandatory requirement for all fee-for-service clients, and instead, DMAP will monitor clients' drug use patterns on a case-by-case basis. DMAP expects to save approximately $40,000 in general funds in the next biennium as a result of this change. The savings have been included in the governor's recommended budget. Another change is the pharmacy reimbursement adjustment. Pharmacy reimbursement adjustment. DMAP reimburses pharmacies for fee-for-service drug products at the lesser of the pharmacy's usual and customary amount billed, or the estimated acquisition cost, or the generic form, minus copay, if any, plus a professional dispensing fee. The estimated acquisition cost is the lesser of the federal upper limit for payment, the Oregon maximum allowable cost, or the average wholesale price, AWP, minus 11% for institutional and 15% for retail pharmacies. United States Congress passed new legislation under the Deficit Reduction Act 2005, changing from the average wholesale price, the AWP pharmacy reimbursement methodology. A new basis for pharmacy reimbursement, the average manufacturer's price or average sales price, is offered by the U.S. Congress to replace AWP. The governor's recommended budget changes the AWP component of DMAP's reimbursement methodology to a reimbursement methodology where an average manufacturer's price or average sales price replaces AWP. DMAP,
a question please?
Is there any distinction between brand name and generic drugs on this? Or is this across the board?
Madam Chair, Senator Westland, as a former pharmacist, actually I'm still a pharmacist, but not a practicing pharmacist, maybe I'll help Alice out here. This is actually a federal change in the way drugs are paid, and it's a move from average wholesale price, which is a little bit like buying a car and thinking you know what the actual cost of the car is. You never do. An average wholesale price, which has been used as kind of the base payment over many years in trying to establish what the cost of drugs is being moved to an average manufacturer's price by the federal government. They've projected savings from that for Medicaid programs. They did it primarily for the savings it would achieve in the federal fund portion of the Medicaid program, but the state should achieve the savings that Alice was mentioning here. It's across the board for all drugs. It's a new way of evaluating the actual cost of manufacturing a drug.
So no distinction between brand name and generics, no different methodology, just exactly the same methodology.
Right. There are a lot of differences between brand and generic, but the new methodology of looking at average manufacturer's price is an attempt to get away from the average wholesale price, which isn't really the average wholesale price of a drug.
Understand.
Sure.
Question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In this new methodology, I want to be certain that we don't put our non-chain pharmacies at risk, especially those in rural areas, mm-hmm. where they might be the only pharmacy for 100 miles. We've had this discussion before. We came close to closing some of those pharmacies down by cutting too low on the reimbursement cost. A lot of our rural communities have a large percentage of people in the Medicaid program, and those pharmacies are the only place they can get those medications quickly and easily. It also brings up the question of using mail-in pharmacies and allowing local pharmacies to compete at the same price for that in order to keep the local pharmacists and that pharmacy open for especially, again, our rural communities. Could you comment on this for us?
Madam Chair,
can I add something to that? Because I was going to ask a question. Because one of my little mom-and-pop pharmacists the other day caught me at the store and was talking about some future changes, but I didn't know what he was talking about at the moment and time. So what I want to do is to make sure that we don't allow the big chains to come and take over because of how we purchase, how our purchasing power is, and how a lot of these little mom-and-pop pharmacies have to go out of business as a result. How do we help protect that marketplace?
Madam Chair, yes, we are very aware of that. We don't want to put small mom-and-pop pharmacies out of business. One of the ways we can help with that is we have a dispensing fee that we pay in addition to this new federally mandated base payment that will be required. We also, in Oregon, have looked at that same situation across the institutional pharmacies, which have higher costs than most retail pharmacies, and have given them a higher dispensing fee than retail pharmacies. And if it appears that there seems to be that kind of an inequity, we can look at that kind of an approach in this situation. Would be one way we could deal with it.
Help my curiosity. Why would an institutional pharmacy be more expensive than somebody outside of an institution?
Madam Chair, the institutional pharmacies package prescription drugs in individual unit dose containers so that they can be dispensed individually, often in institutional settings like nursing homes. It takes considerably more time to do that and to label them appropriately and to get them ready for dispensing to the patient.
Madam Chair, I still have concerns here, and I would ask that we consider at least a later time asking somebody from the pharmacy industry to come in and talk to us about this issue and make sure we all are comfortable with this.
Okay. When we have public health down, Mr. Brittington, make public testimony.
Madam Chair, we have public testimony tomorrow on this budget, so I hope they're listening.
I hope so, too. This is their opportunity.
That's right.
Or to say this a different way, Jim, if the pharmacy in Wagon Tire closes,
Won't pay your way down there. Senator Westland, thank you.
Ms. Lubansky, how much more time do you need?
Well, there was only two other subheadings on page 57, and
okay.
For sake of time, if you would rather I not...
I need the last 10 minutes. We have another piece of legislation.
That's fine.
Thank you.
So would you like me to just end then?
No, you can go up to about 2:20.
Okay. All right.
I think so.
Prior authorization, I'm on page 57. Prior authorization on prescriptions for below-the-line conditions. Diagnosis information is not available on pharmacy claims, preventing our pharmacy processing system to edit against our prioritized list of health services. Currently, DMAP may require prior authorization for select drugs or categories of drugs to ensure that drugs are indicated for funded conditions and to ensure medically appropriate use. The governor's recommended budget expands the number of drugs that require PA to ensure that the medications are prescribed for covered conditions. A condition such as chronic low back pain is a non-covered diagnosis and can be treated with expensive drugs. By requiring prior authorization on these drugs, DMAP will be able to ensure they are prescribed for covered conditions. DMAP expects to save $313,000 in general funds in the next biennium. The savings are included in the governor's recommended budget. And then the last subheading is the pharmacy incentive program. The governor's recommended budget implements a number of policy changes that, taken together, would provide more incentives for pharmacies to dispense drugs that are included on DMAP's pharmacy practitioner-managed prescription drug plan. Our goal is to coordinate drug benefit policies to provide more incentives for pharmacies to use the preferred drugs and provide a zero copay option. Eliminating copays for preferred drugs, will give an incentive to both the client and the dispensing pharmacy to more frequently use the drugs that are on DMAP's preferred drug list. Currently, DMAP limits many prescription drugs to a 34-day fill. Another incentive that we're looking at is expanding the fill time and making a longer prescription fill date and going from a 1 month to 3 months prescription fill where it is safe to do so. That concludes my testimony on quality and efficiency improvements. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to present to you today.
Thank you so much. Good job.
Thank you.
Ms. Sid?
Madam Chair, we're close enough to the end of the time, and you may want to move into the next agenda item for SPD, or would you like us to spend 5 minutes talking about the budget? The budget is the next section of our presentation.
No, let's just begin on that tomorrow. Okay. That's a good place for us to begin tomorrow.
Well, Thursday.
Thursday.
Okay.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Closing the hearing on Hospital 5031, and we'd like to open a work session on the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disability. Mr. Britton.
Madam Chair, thank you. Yesterday I handed out to all members of the subcommittee, or had handed out, a couple of things related to this particular grant. This is a request from the Department of Human Services for the full Ways and Means Subcommittee to approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the United States Department of Labor in the amount of up to $500,000 over 3 years to expand the certified nurse aid workforce. And I have copies of my brief write-up as well as copies of the letter that the department submitted, but also, Madam Chair, Julia Huddleston is here from the department to talk about this particular grant.
Thank you. Ms. Olson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julia Huddleston, and I'm the manager of Planning, Research, and Rate Setting for Seniors and People with Disabilities. I'm here today to request your approval to apply for a Department of Labor, Education, and Training Administration grant in the amount of up to $500,000 for a 36-month period to be focused on development of capacity for recruitment and retention of the certified nurse aide workforce in this state. Governor Kulinowski appointed a staffing commission to look at nursing facility staffing over this past summer, and it was made up of industry representatives and representatives of organized labor. Some certified nurse aides were members of the task force, as were facility owners. That task force decided to recommend an increase in the number of hours per resident day of CNA care in nursing facilities from about 1.66 hours per day to 2.46 hours per resident day. What that equates to over the course of a year is a need for about 700 additional certified nurse aides on the ground at all times to staff Oregon's nursing facilities. When we've spoken to our partners in the Board of Nursing and our industry and labor partners, everybody focuses on not a lack of a willing workforce, but a lack of our capacity to train that workforce. We don't have training that's available and accessible at the times that the people can actually take the training. A lot of these folks, when they're taking their training, also have to hold down another job to keep food on the table. We don't have online training capabilities available. We don't have instructor mentoring. We don't have programs for people who they're an English language learner. So what we propose to do in partnership with the Employment Department, the State Board of Nursing, the two industry associations, the Oregon Healthcare Association and the Oregon Alliance for Senior Health Services, SEIU, and Central Oregon Community College and Lynn Benton Community College, is to put together a partnership to focus on building some scalable, replicable solutions to this sort of a problem. For example, we would use some of this money to fund development of an online curriculum, to fund some mentoring for CNA instructors in not only how to be instructors, but in how to instruct folks who perhaps are in GED-like classes, folks who are English language learners. We'd like to... The Department of Labor really wants to look at regional solutions can be scaled up. We've thought about focusing on the Central Oregon region and kind of a unique definition of the Central Oregon region, Crook, Jefferson, Deschutes, and Klamath counties, because there's already some existing partnerships on the ground that we could build upon, because the demographics of that area are such that you've got an increasingly aging population migrating in. You've got folks, the jobs that are available are service economy jobs and not necessarily as high paying as certainly a CNA job with a career lattice could be built in. So we'd like to go ahead and have your permission to apply for the grant. We would use the grant funding again to build these scalable solutions. We don't expect any long-term general fund impact. The department and its partners would be required to contribute a 25% match. For the department, it would be an in-kind match of staff time for the workforce development. We believe that's true of most of our partners as well.
Are there questions? Representative Garrard, Representative Nathanson.
I've had the opportunity to, when these classes graduate, I mean, it's like a regular graduation party, and I've had the opportunity to attend several in Klamath Falls, mm-hmm. and see the looks on these young people's faces at the opportunity to enter a professional career. And I'm certainly in support of this grant, and will support you any way I can, because this is a great opportunity for young people to not just to serve a need that we all need in our community. So thank you for working on this program, and anytime you need any help, please, you know where to call.
Thank you, Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have no doubt about the need for additional CNAs, no doubt about what a good idea it is to increase the opportunities, not only for the individuals who will receive the training, but for all of us who will need the care now and in the future. This is one of those critical pieces of how to provide health care in a responsible way. What I do have doubt about is, and I'd like your comments, if the training involves community colleges and we are further tying the hands of community colleges to even keep their doors open, if they're in the position of reducing classes and curriculum, how are we going to be able to take advantage of this if we can't adequately support our community colleges?
Senator Carter and Representative Nathanson, that's an excellent question. We do have one thing in our advantage here, though, is that under federal law, certified nurse aid training for nursing facilities, the state Medicaid agency can partially reimburse that training. And we do currently, our industry partners feel that perhaps our training reimbursement methodologies need to be looked at, and I know they have not been looked at for 12 years. We've committed that sometime over the next few months we will take a look at those training methodologies and come back to the February session, if necessary, to talk to you about ways to change those methodologies. But we can get some reimbursement in their hands for that.
Thank you.
Further questions? Your pleasure. I think your pleasure means I need a motion.
Madam Chair.
So late.
I would like to have Senator Winters here make a statement.
I move the subcommittee approve the Department of Human Services Seniors and People with Disabilities application for a U.S. Department of Labor Workforce Development grant. And move it to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation.
Is there a comma now? Senator Weston moves Seniors and People with Disabilities application for a U.S. Department of Labor Workforce Development grant. Are there any objections?
Madam Chair, I can't object, but I would just point out to all of you, it was a semicolon.
Yeah, okay.
I would point out to you that the full committee will have to approve this retroactively. This grant is due on April 5th. The full committee is meeting on April 6th. So technically, it's a retroactive approval. That shouldn't change your motion. I just wanted you to all be aware of that.
Okay.
We were very clear going in. You said that.
Okay.
Would you like me to amend my motion?
It'll
only take about half an hour.
Are there not any objections? I mean, are there any objections?
Madam Chair, save us.
Can I have a carrier for the full committee? Representative Grodd, thank you very much. Committee dismissed. Got 12 minutes to the good.